from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. He's the general who commanded Union troops to victory in the Civil War, the president who led the country through Reconstruction, a champion of civil rights for African Americans in the face of the KKK. That would be Ulysses S. Grant, in case you don't know. And now Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Ron Chernow of Hamilton fame takes on Grant's remarkable life just when we needed a wise eye on the Civil War years and aftermath. With white supremacists in the streets of Charlottesville and White House Chief of Staff John Kelly calling the war the result of a failure to compromise. This hour on Point, Ron Chernow on Ulysses S. Grant and the unfinished legacy of the Civil War. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. We're paying attention at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is writer, journalist, historian, biographer Ron Chernow. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2011 for his biography, Washington, A Life. That's the last time we spoke with him. His biography, Alexander Hamilton, was adapted into the runaway hit musical Hamilton on Broadway. He's out with a big new biography of General and President Ulysses S. Grant, titled simply Grant. You can link to an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ron Chernow, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's great to be with you, Tom. I'll try not to lapse into hip-hop.
Okay, do your best. I know it must be an occupational risk at this point. Gosh, this is a big book and a wonderful book. I can only imagine the work that went into it. Did you have any inkling when you began working on the life of Ulysses S. Grant that it might come out at a time when white supremacy and the Civil War itself would be so hot in our culture?
No, you know, I write a lot about white supremacy in the 1860s and 1870s. And, of course, there's unfortunately a very long history of white supremacist thought in our country. In fact, when Andrew Johnson, who succeeded Abraham Lincoln, when he became president, he said, this is a country for white men. And by God, as long as I'm president, this will be a government for white men. So unfortunately, it has a long and shameful history. And I feel, Tom, that, you know, I had written with Hamilton and Washington, I had written about the founding era, which is a very unifying and uplifting experience for Americans. Mm-hmm. I feel with the Civil War, it continues to be a very kind of divisive and polarizing issue because there's all of this unfinished business from the Civil War. There are still these two competing narratives of what happened. We saw that with General Kelly, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it boils down to the stories that we tell ourselves. And, you know, I've always loved the quote from George Orwell, he who controls the past controls the future. Yeah. He who controls the present controls the past. You know, and when we have people in positions of power talking about American history, it's very, very important that we hold them to, you know, a standard of accountability in terms of accuracy.
I am so eager to come to that and really dig in on it. The lost cause, the understanding of the Civil War. I mean, Ulysses S. Grant's life is so illuminating on the continuing quality of this conflict, and he wrestled so deeply with it in war and in a kind of peace. That you this is so illuminating about what it was like after the Civil War. Would you do us the favor? I mean, you've written the grand story here, but I have learned that not everybody knows the basics. Would you just give us the sort of first straight ahead thumbnail introduction to Ulysses S. Grant, then we can dig in on the deepest elements of it here. But who was this man?
Sure. Grant was born in 1822 in the southwestern corner of Ohio. He was born right near the Ohio River, which separated the free state of Ohio from the slave state of Kentucky. He went to West Point, graduated around the middle of his class, mm-hmm. served with distinction in the Mexican War for several years. He then was assigned to a series of remote, lonely garrisons out on the West Coast, started drinking, was drummed out of the army in disgrace in 1854, suffered a series of terrible business failures. And by the time the war broke out, he'd been reduced to working as a clerk in his father's leather goods store in Galena, Illinois. Mm-hmm. The Confederates fire on Fort Sumter. And then suddenly this man who had been a certifiable failure, 2 months later, he's a colonel, 4 months later, a brigadier general, 10 months later, a major general. And by the end of the war, you know, this former leather goods store clerk is general in chief of the Union Army with 1 million soldiers under his command, but his career doesn't stop there, obviously. Mm-hmm. During the 4 years between the end of the war and his presidency, he still is general-in-chief, very important because the South was under military rule. He was briefly acting Secretary of War, and then he became a two-term president.
Take us back to why he had such a meteoric rise through the ranks during the Civil War. I mean, I have a great Uncle Marcus who fought under Grant, I guess, under Grant at Vicksburg and was wounded there. But what was it about Grant that sent him, once the war began, despite everything, right up through the ranks?
Well, I think that, one thing that I want to point out is that when the Confederates fired on Fort Sumter, Grant suddenly discovered this fierce patriotism, and he wrote a letter to his father. He said, there are now only two parties. There are traitors and patriots. And he felt very, very strongly that because he had been educated at government expense at West Point, that he really owed his loyalty to the Constitution and the flag and the country. There was a terrible shortage of trained officers. Grant still had all of that lore from West Point stored in his head, as well as he'd seen a lot of combat in the Mexican War. But Grant had a strategic genius, he was caricatured as this crude and brutal general. In fact, he was a very elegant and sophisticated military strategist who manages to win the war when Lincoln appoints him general-in-chief, because up until that time in the war, the various Union armies in the separate theaters of war had been operating independently of each other. What Grant does is he begins to coordinate their movement and wells them into a single fighting unit that will apply unremitting pressure against the Confederacy. And it's very interesting, Tom, because so often Lee is hailed as the superior general, Grant as the crude and brutal butcher, but Grant actually captures three Confederate armies during the Civil War at Fort Donelson in Tennessee in 1862, Vicksburg, Mississippi in 1863, mm-hmm. and most famously captures Lee's army at Appomattox Courthouse in 1865. Robert E. Lee never captured a single Union army. So we have to ask ourselves, why has Robert E. Lee been glorified as the great general and Grant denigrated as the butcher? It's very interesting.
I mean, this goes in part to this reinterpretation of the war afterward, which presents the Union victory as just a brute result of overwhelming industrial power and numbers, and Robert E. Lee as the elegant resister. We will look at that. What was the character of Ulysses S. Grant as a general, as president? This becomes interesting as well now, as I read your book, in sharp contrast to the current occupant of the White House.
Yes. I think that, we see in the story of Ulysses S. Grant sort of these wonderful old 19th century virtues that I wish we could bring back. Really his life was guided by a sense of honor, integrity, principle, modesty. There was no self-promotion in Ulysses S. Grant's nature. In fact, after the war, when all of the other Civil War generals rushed to cash in by writing their memoirs and giving their view of history, Grant refused to do so. He thought that there was something kind of preening and egotistical about, rushing to glorify mm-hmm. your own military. And again, modesty at the moment, to put it mildly, is in such short supply that it's very nice to write the story of someone. I never felt that Grant was self-consciously setting out to achieve fame and glory. Rather, he was just a man doing his patriotic duty. And he did it so well and so conscientiously that the fame and glory came as a byproduct of doing his patriotic duty. I wish there were more examples of that sort at the moment.
You've got this anecdote where he's in Vicksburg, I guess, after it's taken and needs a shave. He looks like hell, it sounds from the way he was described there after all the fighting. Goes into a barbershop with some of his aides. They want to throw a lower-ranking trooper right out of his barber chair. And Grant says, no, this guy deserves a shave as much as I do. I mean, that's the real deal.
Yeah, he always treated people with tremendous dignity. He treated his troops as peers. In fact, he would never strut and lord it over his troops. He didn't have fancy military reviews where he would play the, conquering hero. The only way that you would know that he was the general was that, because he would just be wearing a kind of private's, uniform, he would just have these three stars on his shoulder straps. Otherwise, you wouldn't have known that he was the man who was in command of a million soldiers. So it's a lovely story of a very modest, understated, and self-effacing man.
At life's end, he heroically finally did write his memoirs to dig out of being defrauded and terrible financial difficulty. Mark Twain published them, of all things, and it's very touching to see this man in his final days working like a demon to churn these out so that his family might have some means after he passed.
Yeah, it's an amazing story because, as I said, you know, he had vowed never to write his memoirs. But then two terrible things happened more or less simultaneously a year before he dies. Number one, he's the victim of the Bernie Madoff of his day. Grant was incurably naive when it came to business. He fancied that Ward had made him a multimillionaire, and he wakes up one day and he finds it's a Ponzi scheme and he's worth 80 bucks. Yeah. And then, unfortunately, what happens around the same time, he's diagnosed with cancer of the throat and tongue. He's petrified that he will leave his wife, Julia, destitute. So in a great pain from the cancer, it's a very excruciating way to die. Grant, during the final years of his life, writes this memoir. It's 335,000 words. It's considered the greatest military memoir in American letters. And it's as if with this great granite determination, he wills himself to stay alive. And he puts down his pen, having completed the book just a few days before finishing the book. It's very inspiring.
Mark Twain publishes it. All that for his wife who had been a slave owner. It's a complicated time. The way we understand that time, at the heart of so much that's swirling around us right now, Ron Chernow's new biography, and it is magnificent, of Ulysses S. Grant, is titled simply Grant. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Ron Chernow. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
This podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter. What if hiring could be easier? So even when you're busy, you can still be smart about how you hire. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 top job boards with just one click. Then their smart technology notifies the most qualified candidates to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. Right now, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/OP. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OP. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Ron Chernow's new biography of Ulysses S. Grant, the man who gave us Hamilton, now goes deep on the general who won the Civil War and guided Reconstruction as President of the United States. The new biography is titled simply Grant. Ron Chernow joins us from New York. Of course, he wrote the book on which the Broadway super hit Hamilton was based. Last time with us here, he was talking about George Washington, won a Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Washington. You can join the conversation this hour. Are you thinking about the Civil War these days? As General John Kelly, White House Chief of Staff, talks about a failure to compromise as the cause of the Civil War, as white supremacists have marched so recently in Charlottesville and Confederate monuments are under fire, can you imagine the scope of Ulysses S. Grant's work nailing the Civil War victory, wrestling with Reconstruction in the face of the KKK? Ron Chernow, can we just listen to a moment to John Kelly and begin to bring the current into the past? There's a lot more about the past I want to hear. But this was the general, now chief of staff of the White House, on Laura Ingraham's inaugural show on Fox on Monday, talking about what led to the Civil War.
The lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War. And men and women of good faith on both sides made their stand where their conscience had them make their stand.
Comments right there about the compromise and also the kind of eerie echoing of Donald Trump's comments after the Charlottesville mess about how good people on both sides. And there was more. Here was General Kelly, John Kelly, on Robert E. Lee.
I would tell you that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which in 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days.
John Kelly, President Trump's chief of staff. Ron Chernow, against the backdrop of this magnificent work on Grant and the Civil War so much in your mind, what are your thoughts on those comments?
Well, let's take the compromise comment first. And I have to say, you know, General Kelly, as four-star Marine general, yep. Lieutenant general, and he actually has two master's degrees, one in strategic studies from Georgetown School of Foreign Service mm-hmm. and the other from the National Defense University. So this is really someone, by virtue of his education and by virtue of his rank, whom you think would be intimately familiar with both the military and political aspects of the Civil War. You know, my reaction in terms of the compromise statement is that for 75 years, the country had been doing nothing but compromise.
Before the Civil War.
Going back to the Constitutional Convention. You know, we're always taught in school the big debate at the Constitutional Convention was between the big states and the small states. But James Madison said it was really between the northern and the southern states and that it revolved around slavery. And a compromise was built into the Constitution where the slave trade was protected for 20 years. The South was allowed to count slaves as kind of three-fifths mm-hmm. of the slave population as if they were really citizens.
Partial people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then in 1820, we have the Missouri Compromise. Missouri enters as a slave state. Maine is a free state. 1850, we have yet another compromise. California enters as a free state, but the South gets a strengthened fugitive slave law. 1854, we get the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which allows the Kansas and Nebraska territories to decide for themselves if they want slavery, but that expands slavery beyond the line from the old Missouri Compromise. You know, and then, Tom, even in the weeks and months before Lincoln's inauguration, there were 13 senators who were frantically meeting trying to craft constitutional amendments that would guarantee to the South that they would never interfere with slavery in their states. And then finally, you know, Lincoln had to tell them, he, in a direct quote, entertained no proposition for a compromise in regard to the extension of slavery. Lincoln had already, as had the Republican Party, made a compromise in terms of repeatedly reassuring the South that they could preserve slavery where it already existed, but they refused to allow it to expand and take over the country. So we had tried nothing but compromise for 75 years. And every one of those compromises that I mentioned, Tom, ended up simply inflaming and polarizing the situation more.
So what's embedded in this telling of the Civil War from General John Kelly, who's right there in the Oval Office, highly, you know, super high ranking in the Marine Corps, you know, advanced degrees. But we talk about narratives. There's something going on here with the American narrative that leaves him with making this observation.
I guess, you know, where that's coming from, because it's not coming from, you know, direct knowledge of history, I guess it's a kind of, you know, desire to have compromise and civility in our contemporary political discourse. But if he's looking for, you know, an example of you know, failure of compromise in our history, he really turned to the wrong place. And I think, unfortunately, we have to call him out on it.
I mean, but he absolves the South. He says men and women of good faith on both sides. What do you make of that?
Let's talk about, you know, Robert E. Lee a little bit, because mm-hmm. there's a, you know, rather sentimental tale that's always told that when the Civil War broke out, Lee felt that he had to go with his native state of Virginia. And so it's presented in this, again, very sentimental terms of his emotional attachment to his friends and his family and the state where he had grown up. I found as I got more deeply into the research about Robert E. Lee was that he was a real true believer when it came to the ideology of the Confederacy. He later said, "We had, I was satisfied, sacred principles to maintain and rights to defend, even if we perished in the endeavor." And even though he claimed to be critical of slavery in theory, let me just read you what he said about slavery. Mm-hmm. He said, "Slavery was a greater evil to the white man than to the black race. Blacks," and here he's talking about slaves, he said, "blacks are immeasurably better off here than in Africa, morally, socially, and physically. And here's the real kicker. The painful discipline they are undergoing is necessary for their instruction as a race, and I hope will prepare and lead them to better things." And even after the Civil War in 1868, he signs a manifesto calling for the restoration of the kindness and humanity of the slave system. So this is not just simply someone who's, you know, feeling loyal to his state.
Wait, did he want kindness and humanity, or did he want slavery back? I mean, not that.
What he was saying was that slavery represented kindness and humanity to the blacks, because it was part of the painful discipline necessary for their instruction. I mean, these are incredible stories, and these are things that tend to get papered over in terms of this, you know, sentimental talk of reconciliation between North and South. And I think that we have to, you know, see Lee accurately in his totality, that he was a strong believer in the basic principles of the Confederacy. And, you know, in this Lost Cause school that started in the South after the Civil War, and this is still incorporated into many Southern textbooks, you know, that the cause of the war was states' rights, not slavery. Well, if you go back to what was actually being said by the Confederacy at the time it was formed, Alexander Stephens, who was the vice president of the Confederacy, said that the cornerstone of the Confederacy was the notion that the black man was inferior to the white, that slavery was his natural state. And he said the Confederacy was the first country in history created on that great principle. In fact, James Longstreet, who was Robert E. Lee's main commander, mm-hmm. when later asked about this notion that the Civil War was about states' rights, Longstreet laughed and said, gee, that's funny. During the 4 years of the Civil War, I never heard anything but slavery mentioned as the reason for it. But this is kind of a rewriting of history. And unfortunately, you know, this really misleading narrative about what happened is still with us. It's one of the reasons that we're still fighting with ourselves, because there are these two competing stories.
We're getting the story through Grant's eyes in your biography, and you write that Grant, I'm quoting you here, Grant came to believe that Lee, Robert E. Lee, far from accepting the war's outcome gracefully, was secretly hostile to it and abetted Southern fantasies that their defeated cause would rise anew. You've got a wonderful telling here of the two meeting at Appomattox. They had met before. I think it was in Veracruz during the Mexican War. Lee, much superior in rank to Grant then. But now Grant was the victorious general. Robert E. Lee decked out in tremendous splendor. Grant, not nearly so splendid.
Right.
But you have a bit here. I guess, was this from his own memoir later when he writes about that meeting? And it gets to General Kelly talking about men of good faith on both sides, this kind of equalizing.
Yes, I know the quote you're talking about, Tom. I would love to read it, because mm-hmm. I think that it kind of says everything.
This
that
is when they're actually meeting at the courthouse in Appomattox.
Yeah, so this is Appomattox Courthouse, kind of April 1865. This is how Grant remembers it in his famous memoirs. Quote, "What General Lee's feelings were, I do not know. As he was a man of much dignity, with an impassible face, it was impossible to say whether he felt inwardly glad that the end had finally come, or felt sad over the result and was too manly to show it. Whatever his feelings, they were entirely concealed from my observation. But my own feelings, which had been quite jubilant on the receipt of his letter, were sad and depressed. I felt like anything rather than rejoicing at the downfall of a foe who had fought so long and valiantly and had suffered so much for a cause, though that cause was, I believe, one of the worst for which a people ever fought, and one for which there was the least excuse." Well, one can't imagine a better formulation, because here Grant is high-minded enough, big enough to say, mm-hmm. my foes were tremendously valiant, and to really credit the courage of the Confederate officers and the soldiers, but at the same time making a distinction that they were fighting for really a reprehensible cause, which was the preservation of slavery. You know, and I like the fact he gets both nuances exactly right.
Amazing reading his elegant prose in the midst of your wonderful prose, kind of super, two punch there. Callers for you, Ron Chenow. The new biography is Grant. It is tremendous. Rebecca is calling from Kentucky, Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Rebecca. You're on the air with Ron Chenow.
Hi, Tom and Ron. It's interesting. You were just talking about compromise, because I'm in Kentucky, actually Lexington, the home of Henry Clay, who was known as the Great Compromiser. Mm. And when I heard Kelly's comment the other day, I was quite stunned that he was unaware that Henry Clay, a Southerner in a slave state, was a very important player in trying to find compromise prior to the Civil War. The second point I wanted to make is that I had the, I'm going to say, unfortunate experience of being moved from upstate New York to Middle Tennessee when I was 16. And this is in the 70s. And my senior year, I took a class called American History, and there was another young woman whose parents were academics, and they had moved her from St. Lawrence up in the St. Lawrence Seaway. And we were sitting next to each other in American History, and the teacher, an older woman, was talking about the wall of Northern aggression. And when she started teaching this, the first thing she taught was, and she had them written on the board, the reasons why the South should have won the Civil War, not the reasons why the North did win the Civil War. And my friend and I sat there just stunned, and the teacher turned to us and said, I think our Northern compatriots have an issue. And so Jill and I looked at each other and said, okay, let's go for it. And so we proceeded to rebut her points. The South had more guns. The South had more and better generals. The South had farms, so they had more food. And I don't remember what the other ones were. And so we rebutted it. And it's interesting, we were ostracized for over a month in the school.
Rebecca, let us pick it up right there. We've got Ron with us, and I want to get his reaction to just how durable these fixed views of the war turn out to be, Ron.
Yeah, I just want to say, going back, I'm glad you brought up Henry Clay, because, you know, his speeches and the Compromise of 1850, Daniel Webster, these used to be speeches that American school children knew by heart in terms of the Compromise of 1850. Now, even at the highest levels of government, you know, people don't remember it, which is sad. I want to talk about this idea of, you know, first, the war of Northern aggression. You know, when the war broke out, and throughout the war in his presidency, Grant always referred to it as the rebellion, that it was an illegal rebellion. It was a, you know, treasonous rebellion. The argument that was made, you know, by Jefferson Davis in the South was that they could not rebel because they were sovereign states, and sovereign states can't rebel. But again, this is kind of a misreading of American history and the Constitution, because when the Constitution was created, we were no longer, as had been the case under the Articles of Confederation, where it was a compact of sovereign states. Constitution starts, we the people. The Constitution was a direct contract between every individual American citizen and the federal government, which is why the Constitution was ratified not by the state legislatures but by, you know, conventions of citizens in each state. But, you know, because the South tried, you know, very, very hard to say that they were really the heirs of the American Revolution, that, you know, Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis, they were the new George Washington's fighting, you know, against an oppressive centralized government. And Abraham Lincoln was very shrewd and very careful to make sure that the South fired first, for precisely, he was trying to avoid what happened anyway, of the South arguing that it was a war of Northern aggression.
And there, Grant, I mean, one of the most powerful vast portions here is how hard he struggled after the war, after this amazing victory. It's as if the war kind of started up again on different terms during Reconstruction, and opposition to it, that was right in his lap as president.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one episode that we should talk about, Tom, is, you know, just within a month or two after Appomattox, a grand jury in Norfolk, Virginia, wants to indict Robert E. Lee for treason, not just Lee, but James Longstreet, Joseph Johnston, all the Confederate generals. Grant, as part of his agreement at Appomattox, had promised Lee that he would be immune to prosecution for treason, which would have meant execution. And Grant and Lincoln both felt that the only way to end the war at that point was to make that promise of freedom from prosecution of treason. Then this, in late May 1865, grand jury in Norfolk, Virginia, suddenly starts handing down these indictments against Lee and others for treason. Grant goes to President Andrew Johnson, who wanted to prosecute, and says that they have to live up to the agreement. Grant actually threatens to quit if Lee is prosecuted for treason and the treason prosecution is dropped. But I think that we never really had the truth and reconciliation process that we needed.
But a stern moral pronouncement in your reading there from Grant, the worst cause for which a people ever fought. Very clear on that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Ron Chernow. His new biography is on Ulysses S. Grant. It is titled simply Grant. He wrote the book from which the Broadway smash hit Hamilton came, about the life of Alexander Hamilton. Now he goes into the Civil War and its aftermath through the experience of a man who was the general who nailed the Union victory and who served as president in the heart of Reconstruction in the South. That is quite a story in itself. It's a terrific book. He joins us from New York. You can join us as well. Can you imagine the scope of Ulysses S. Grant's work here in the battlefield and in the White House? And what does learning about Grant leave you thinking about the presidency now, our challenges now, the man in the White House? A couple of clips here from Grant letters. These are from a PBS American Experience. But Grant had resigned, as Ron says, in 1854 from the Army, gone back to Missouri, Illinois, lived with his wife's family, and then beyond. When the Civil War broke out, 1861, joined the Army again as a soldier and commander. Here he was reading a letter that he wrote to his father. This is from American Experience, that Grant wrote to his father in 1861.
There are but two parties now, Grant wrote his father, traitors and patriots, and I want hereafter to be ranked with the latter. We have a government, laws, and a flag, and they must all be sustained.
Two parties now, traitors and patriots, and bloody, bloody war, yes, 1864, determined to crush Robert E. Lee and his army of North Virginia. They had the Battle of the Wilderness, Spotsylvania, Cold Harbor, Siege of Petersburg, effectively destroyed the rebel army that year. Grant lost 44,000 men. Here's a reading again from one of his letters to his wife, Julia Dent Grant, her family, slave owners until emancipation. This was May 13th, 1864.
Dear Julia, the world has never seen so bloody or so protracted a battle as the one being fought, and I hope never will again.
There's a hope. It was bloody as could be. Ron Chernow joins us. The new biography is Grant Lafayette is Calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Lafayette, you're on with Ron Chernow.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to thank your author for clarifying what Grant really thought when he made the statement that the states in rebellion were traitors, and they were either traitors or patriots. I totally agree with him, and I think the fact that he could succinctly characterize the situation helped him defeat General Lee and the Southern forces. Right now in our country, I believe that we've got two sets of people. Those who believe in the proposition that all men are created equal and endowed with and so forth, certain there and so forth and so on.
Yep.
Those who believe in that proposition and those who don't believe in that proposition. And we've got people marching under flags, Nazi flags, Confederate flags, as if they forgot just a generation ago, millions of men and women mobilized to defeat the very that very idea of Nazism.
Mm-hmm.
As if their cousins and fathers and mothers and brothers didn't go and shed blood to stop the Nazis. Yet, they can parade up and down the street flying that flag and also having the president say, oh, they're good citizens. And they are traitors. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day. He was a veteran. I'm not a veteran. And he came right out with it. He said, those traitors. I was like, traitors? It's like not politically correct to call the Southerners traitors.
Lafayette, may we pick it up right there? Your judgment is crystalline. Ron Chernow, what are you thinking as Lafayette lays it out?
Well, first of all, as Hamilton's biographer, I love having someone calling in whose name is Lafayette. So hello, Lafayette, and thank you for the call. You know, you were just mentioning Lafayette, you know, the parades, white supremacists, Nazis. I was thinking about a different set of parades, and they were the parades that were held at the time the Confederate monuments, you know, went up. Now these are Confederate monuments that are just kind of sitting there, you know, in a street corner or in a park. But if you kind of go back to the late 19th century when these statues were going up, the dedication ceremonies, there would be these huge rallies. The first one went up in Richmond, 1875. It was a Stonewall Jackson monument. And these were political events. 50,000 people showed up for the dedication of the monument. Blacks were banned from being part of it. The Confederate General Jubal Early said if blacks came, it would be an insult to the Confederacy. Cool. There was a very heavy Ku Klux Klan, you know, presence at the dedication to the monument. And these Confederate monuments all had this kind of, you know, history behind them. And that on the one hand, it was the South's very a defiant response to Reconstruction, saying that Reconstruction was over, and really signaling to the African-American community that all of the gains they had made during Reconstruction, where there were hundreds of blacks serving in Southern legislatures, there were 14 blacks serving in the U.S. House of Representatives and 2 blacks serving in the U.S. Senate. These monuments were going up and making sort of a big statement saying that is all over and you were going to return to the subservient position that you had before the war, albeit minus slavery.
Are you willing to take up Lafayette's challenge to deploy direct language about people's positions today, Ron? He wants to bring back traitor and patriot there.
Yeah, I mean, what can I say, Tom? I mean, it's absolutely, you know, shameful what happened in Charlottesville. And, you know, I had to think as I was following that coverage, you know, and you know, the president and others drawing a kind of false equivalence between the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists and the people who were protesting this. Ulysses S. Grant, in his second term as president, was bemoaning exactly these things, saying that because as these, they were called redeemer governments, as these white supremacist governments, you know, recaptured states that had, you know, had biracial governments during Reconstruction. Grant began to bemoan the fact that suddenly in descriptions of the war that people were saying that not only had both sides fought with equal valor, which he believed, but that both sides had been animated by equally high principles, which he did not. So it's really a depressing case of history repeating itself.
Jay in Tampa, Florida, you're on with Ron Chernow. Lafayette, thanks for your call from Baltimore. Jay, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
During the Civil War, wealthy whites got poor white people to support the destruction of the United States for a nation whose founding principle was that it was better to enslave a black person than to pay a white person for work. For this support, white privilege was extended to people, and that's to many more white people, and that's been the deal ever since, that white privilege by many is paid for with white silence about racism and oppression. Problem as a nation is that we don't respect our history, we don't go back and read the words, and we don't take the lesson seriously about what it means. And it's not just a black-white issue, because there have always been white people who have been true patriots and believed in equality from the very founding of our nation.
Jay, I'm very grateful for your call. Ron, I wish you'd respond to that any way you like, but I wish you'd give us some Reconstruction-era history as well and Grant's role there. I mean, Jay speaks a lot of truth, and Grant was right up against it. The war sort of broke out again under the covers. The KKK emerged, and there was an entire system that people would not let go of.
Yeah, I mean, you know, right before Grant became president and very much through his influence, we passed the 15th Amendment, which gave blacks, at least male blacks, the right to vote. And the black population of the South at the time was 36%, but there were states, South Carolina, Mississippi, where blacks constituted a majority of the population. Mm-hmm. So what happened, there was a violent white backlash against this, and It took the form of the Ku Klux Klan, which began to reign by terror in every county in the South. And there was no Southern sheriff who would arrest a member of the Klan, no Southern white who would testify against a member of the Klan, no Southern jury who would convict a member of the Klan. And so Grant had to repeatedly send federal troops into the South. He appointed a crusading attorney general from Georgia named Amos Ackerman. The Justice Department had just been created, very different Justice Department from the current one. Justice Department had just been created, brought more than 3,000 indictments against the Ku Klux Klan, got more than 1,000 convictions, and crushed the Klan. This was an extraordinary achievement. The Ku Klux Klan that we think of today stemmed from the revival of the Klan in the 19-teens and 1920s. You know, and I felt in writing the book, Grant's presidency is often, you know, caricatured as dominated by scandals and corruption. And there were scandals, and we can talk about that. But I felt that far and away, the bigger story of his presidency was his profound sense of commitment to protecting the 4 million former slaves who had now become full-fledged American citizens with the right to vote. And I should say, Tom, that before Grant began to prosecute them, use federal law to prosecute them, there had been not tens, not hundreds, but thousands of blacks murdered in the South without a single prosecution. So it was the biggest outbreak of mass terrorism in American history. And given all the interest in terrorism, you'd think we would hear about this, but we don't.
You don't present him as a perfect man. You describe him as naive about corruption among those around him as president.
Yeah.
You're quite open about his alcoholism with which he wrestled.
Yeah.
Every few months he would sort of wrestle with that. But throughout, you see him as a real civil rights champion in a time when certainly not everyone was on that bandwagon, though many fought and died for civil rights there. Frederick Douglass spoke of Grant in quite glowing terms, you remind us.
Yeah, Frederick Douglass said, you know, to Ulysses S. Grant, the Negro more than any other man owns his enfranchisement. On another occasion, he said that Grant was the vigilant, firm, impartial, and wise protector of our race. So when Grant ran for re-election in 1872, Douglass counted 250 black employees in one department alone. Grant was the first president who invited blacks to participate in his inaugural ball, and actually a lot of whites boycotted it for that reason. There was a New Year's Day ritual they used to have at the White House where citizens would stream through. Grant was the first president who allowed, you know, blacks to enter on an equal basis as whites. He appointed the first black diplomats, ambassador to Haiti, ambassador to Liberia, etc., etc., and that this is so often kind of excluded from the image of Grant's presidency. He also appointed a record number of Jews, appointed head of Commissioner of Indian Affairs, a full-blooded Seneca sachem. And so we really had kind of quite a wonderful record on what we today would call diversity and inclusiveness. Mm.
Lorenz is calling from Tennessee, Nashville, Tennessee. Lorenz, you're on with Ron Chernow.
Hey, thank you. I just wanted to comment on looking at history and maybe looking at media today. It seems to me that people sort of want to find the parts of history or the parts of maybe a news story that support their idea. And I think this is a very important thing that we're missing, and that is to find the real truth. I'm actually a direct relative of Jefferson Davis, but from the South, but I grew up with very liberal college professors, and we were absolutely taught that prejudice was wrong and that everyone should be judged by the content of their character and to find the moral truth. And I see, looking at history and also looking at news events today, that seems to be a little lost.
I would love to, you know, comment because I spent a lot of time, I'm from New York, but I spent a lot of time in the South, obviously researching Grant because so many of his battles were fought in the South. And a couple of, you know, responses to that wonderful comment. You know, what I'm noticing is among younger people in the South, I think there's much less attachment to these Confederate symbols and monuments than perhaps had been the case with their parents and grandparents. And I think that for earlier generations, you know, very much the sense of Southern identity, you know, was shaped by the Confederacy and the lost cause afterwards. And I just, you know, I love the South, and I think that there are so many beautiful things that have come out of the South. Some of our greatest literature, you know, much of our greatest music comes out of the South. You know, and I'm hoping that as the years go on, that kind of attachment to Confederate symbols will weaken, and Southern, you know, pride will gather more and more around the arts and the music and the other great accomplishments of the region.
We're just back from Atlanta here at On Point, and with people who are saying, look, what we want is truth. And mm-hmm. a very kind of sophisticated reassessment there. One last question from the audience, from the listeners here. Jason says, is the flattering patina of history, is it the flattering patina of history, or were past presidents like Washington, Lincoln, et cetera, maybe Grant, truly giants of leadership to whom we have no parallels today, Ron?
I think those three, you know, were giants of leadership. And I feel that, you know, in terms of the presidency, the most important thing that we should look for with the presidency is kind of moral clarity and moral authority. And when I look at all the major presidents in American history, they were all people who expanded the sense of freedom and tolerance, you know, and in Grant's case, it took enormous courage to carry out that crusade against the Klan. The White South, you know, predictably was up in arms about it. But he also was dealing with a shrinking political base in the North from his own Republican Party. And interestingly enough, it was the liberal Republicans who began to undermine Reconstruction. So Grant was kind of fighting a two-front battle.
Moral clarity as the hallmark of a great president, but never easy to pursue by any means. An amazing story of Ulysses S. Grant. Ron Chernow tells it in his new biography, Grant. Just a fabulous and deeply illuminating read, Ron, and we thank you for it. Thanks for all your work. Thanks for being with us
today. Thank you, Tom. I always love being on with you.
Thank you very much. Ron Chernow, the new biography is Grant. You can continue this conversation, dear listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website or wherever you get your podcasts. Go to onpointradio.org or beyond. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for being with us today. This is On Point.